Listener Production. Hi, I'm Helen McCabe, Managing Director and Founder of FW. I began life as a journalist, held senior roles in newspapers, edited Australia's largest magazine, and in 2018, I launched my own business. FW is dedicated to helping women navigate their working lives. But I've made my share of mistakes, especially as a leader. In this series, I go in search of answers to often complex leadership challenges. I explore the latest thinking on how to be a great leader and return to the tried and true methods to better understand what works and in what situations. It is a bit of a cliche that we are all leaders in a way, but it's true. The interesting thing to note, however, is at what stage does this dawn on us? My guest today is Winnie Dunn, a writer of Tongan descent from Mount Druitt in Sydney. She's the general manager of Sweatshop Literacy Movement and holds a Bachelor of Arts from Western Sydney University. Winnie is also completing her debut novel. In this episode, we explore the value of thinking about leadership from an early age and how to lead from behind. Winnie Dunn, welcome to the FW Leadership Series. I want to start today by talking about your writing. Tell me, what are you working on?
Hi, Helen. Thanks so much for having me. I'm actually working on my debut novel. It's called Dirt Poor Islanders. It's the first own voices Pacifica Australian fiction book that's been published in Australia to date, which feels quite overwhelming. But I'm very excited for listeners and readers across the continent to get to know a little bit more about their Pacifica neighbours, especially the Tongan Australian community through Dirt Poor Islanders.
I have done a little bit of book publishing. It is one of, if not the hardest thing that I have done in my career. So congratulations to you. How have you found the process?
Oh, thank you so much. The process, because when I first started kind of writing as an adult, I was actually in my first year of university. I'm the first person in my family to go to university, so that was around 2017. I had always loved writing as a child, but I didn't have much resources or knowledge around creative writing or literature, but I just had this innate desire to want to write and tell stories. And so I actually went to a writing workshop at Western Sydney University, run by Dr. Michael Muhammad Ahmed, who's the founding director of Sweatshop. And then from there, I kind of built my knowledge literally sentence by sentence about how to construct words and language. The ancient Latin word for text is woven. So I literally had to learn how to stitch sentences together. And then from there, in my role at Sweatshop, I kind of spent 5 years slowly developing my craft. And then by the time I was ready to write a novel, I had kind of 30,000 words that I kind of meshed together. And then I just wrote Dirt Poor Islanders from there. And just seeing the iteration of it kind of coming to life after each editorial process has been really amazing. And the reception so far, even though it comes out March 27, the book proofs have gone out. And apparently they had to print book proofs again for Dirt Poor Islanders because so many booksellers were asking for them. So I feel really excited. And the process was really wonderful for me to keep growing in my writing craft as well.
Let's talk a little bit about leading as a writer and in your day job. Do you consider yourself a leader?
That's a complicated question for me, intersectional-wise, I would say. In terms of myself as a writer, I do see myself as a leader in terms of being the quote-unquote first Tongan Australian to have written and published a work of fiction or a novel, because the only kind of Pacifica Australian writer that we have in our history is actually a writer who was born in Tahiti called Celestine Hitaruawaite. And she was writing in the very early 2000s, 2005 era. And since then, there's been a really huge gap in terms of Pacifica storytelling. But in between that gap was really traumatic because there was the infamous Summer Heights High, who was created by an Anglo-Saxon comedian that we all know named Chris Lilley, who donned like brown face paint and an Afro wig and took on this really heavy accent and depicted these really violent, hypersexual, illiterate depictions of a Tongan child. Like, I think people often forget that he was playing a young high school boy, I think in year 7 or 8. So growing up in that context, for me as a Tongan Australian, was quite overwhelming, and it really degraded me as a person and the way that I thought about myself. And it was only through writing Dirt Poor Islanders and becoming a writer that I was able to feel like a leader. And that's because of the theory proposed by African American feminist and scholar Bell Hooks, who talks about moving from silence to voice as a revolutionary gesture. So centering my, being able to center my own voice as a writer and as a storyteller enabled me to be a reader, a leader and a reader.
And that's a beautiful answer. And it is really distressing to hear the impact that that program had on a young life. I imagine the lives of the boys around you were equally affected.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think when we think about leadership in general, we can kind of pull all men into that category. But really, there's so many delicate intersections and layers, because in my community, Pacific Islander men are not leaders at all. They're actually at the bottom of the rung in terms of being factory workers, security guards, and footballers. You know, they're kind of puppets for the nation to use their bodies, but they're not actually leading anything or doing anything that would be considered a leadership role in any meaningful capacity. So to me, obviously, the work of Summer Heights High and Jonah from Tonga really affected me. And obviously, I can't speak on behalf of the men in my community, but I can say that where I am, an equivalent of me who's a Pacifica male is probably 10 years behind where I am, specifically because of Chris Lilley's work.
Really interesting insight into the ripple effects. At what point then did you feel activated, if that's the right word, in a sense that you had a voice and that you could follow the footsteps of feminist writers that you admired?
Yeah, well, again, to bring up the theories of feminist and scholar Bell Hooks, who I greatly admire, she also talks about this really powerful concept of mirroring and how empowering mirroring can be. So the concept of mirroring is that she uses this beautiful example of a quite awkward picture of the then President Barack Obama. And you can kind of tell that the picture was taken in the moment because the camera angle was quite unique and skewed. But the image depicts the then President Barack Obama bending down to a young African-American boy. And the boy was reaching up to touch his hair. And the background context of that photo that Bell Hooks analyzed and researched is that the context of that photo is that that young African-American boy had one question to ask the President of the United States. And the young boy said, "Is your hair like mine?" And then Barack Obama just said, just bent down and said, "Feel for yourself." And in that moment, in that picture, we can see the power and liberation and justice that comes with seeing yourself in a position of leadership where there hasn't been before, because we all know Barack Obama was the first Black president. So in my mind, seeing somebody like me or who came from a similar background to me in a position of leadership was that spark, was that ignition to start seeing the potential that I could have as a leader. And so the person who did that for me was the founding director of Sweatshop, Dr. Michael Muhammad Ahmed. He is from an Arab Australian background, Muslim, so very different from my own Tongan Australian Christian upbringing. But the thing that we had in common and the thing that really sparked my imagination and desire to lead was the fact that we were both from Western Sydney. And again, Western Sydney is very demonized by the nation as a place kind of full of low socioeconomic dull bludgers, I would say. No leaders there either. And a perfect example of that is the first season of SBS's Struggle Street, where the opening credits of that show was this very picturesque harbour bridge. It zoomed through Sydney and then it landed on a welcome to Mount Druitt sign, which is the suburb I grew up in. And then a fart noise played. And it was like,
wow.
Yeah, it was like I was in the butt end of Sydney. And so race and class wise, I was made to feel really humiliated and unworthy of anything other than kind of being a factory worker and having a family. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I was very limited in what I could see of myself and people like me until I walked into that writing workshop at Western Sydney University and saw a doctor of literature who also happened to be from Western Sydney and grew up there his whole life. And it was actually the first time that I discovered that there was literature being created from Western Sydney. So in that writing workshop, we kind of analysed and deconstructed and reconstructed this very, very short, sharp poem by what we discovered through our analysis of the poem were just by two young boys from Western Sydney who are making fun of each other because they're friends. And for me, learning that in a university context, that kind of language and vernacular that I'd grew up in my whole life but didn't see as something worthy of representation was so amazing to me that I just had to be part of it.
I did want to ask earlier in this interview about Mount Druitt, and I skipped the question, but I do think, you know, you've just ignited why I wanted to ask about it, because Sydney's a city of villages and very distinct cultures. And if you're in your village, you very rarely move beyond it if you live in Sydney. And if you live in another part of Australia, you kind of don't know much about an area like Western Sydney, even though it's, as you say, it's very, very talked about, particularly in a political context around who gets to be Prime Minister often gets decided by the voters of Western Sydney. So tell us, what's Mount Druitt like?
Yeah, well, Western Sydney as a whole context, I think people forget that it's the largest part of New South Wales and it's the most densely populated. And this is probably lowballing it, but there's over 80 to 100 different languages being spoken at any one time. And it's so vast and so different. And growing up in Mount Druitt, I like to summarise it as me growing up, it's just the place where I felt art went to die. Like I just didn't feel like I couldn't see any writers, I couldn't see any artists. It was just kind of go to school, go home, and just that kind of repetition over and over again. But that kind of poverty porn that was depicted, I would say, in Struggle Street was something I also didn't experience, because in that show it was full on. It was like there was a young teenage girl who was pregnant, who was drug addicted, there's just lots of needles, there's, you know, and they're all trying to cheat Centrelink. And so I didn't grow up in that kind of skewed version of Mount Druitt either. For me, it was just very mundane and ordinary. It wasn't anything exceptional. And it's only recently in the media that Mount Druitt has become a place that's kind of unique or special in the sense of the Pacifica drill rap crew 1-4. So they're kind of Australia's biggest rap group. And they're made of Pacific Islander men, mainly Samoans, who rap and who speak about their lived experience of growing up in a very low socioeconomic area as men of colour. And, you know, their rise in popularity really cemented this idea that Mount Druitt is a place where art can thrive and where art can be created, and that Mount Druitt is actually a source of inspiration for artists who come from there. And in my own book, Dirt Poor Islanders, it's very, very much centered on Mount Druitt and growing up in Mount Druitt and just the beauty and the mundane, I suppose, of what it means to, of what the actual reality is of growing up in Western Sydney.
Tell me, as part of your work at Sweatshop Literacy, what does your day entail?
So for me, as the general manager of Sweatshop, it can kind of, it's a very broad range of roles and responsibilities that I have. My main one is being a lead workshop facilitator for the Sweatshop Women's Group. So the Sweatshop Women's Group I started in 2018 as a direct response to the Me Too movement, and in particular, Hollywood's hijacking of the Me Too movement, because as we know, or as people might not know, the Me Too movement was actually founded by an African-American woman named Tarana Burke, who was specifically working with a very underprivileged, underclassed Black women in America who had been violently sexually assaulted, and was using her grassroots movement of Me Too to give voice to those specific women. And then when it was kind of hijacked by the Hollywood elite, it just became this kind of facade almost of what it was actually meant to be. And so for me, starting Sweatshop Women in 2018, I wanted to go back to Tarana Burke's original vision of Me Too, which was to give underprivileged and underclass minority women a chance to tell their own story. And so from that workshop group of about 80 women, it was really huge. And we got to learn from the best of the best in terms of the leaders in Australian women's writing, like Dr. Rhonda Abdul-Fattah, Dr. Sarah Ayoub, Michelle de Kretzer, who's a multi-award winning author. I think she's won the Miles Franklin twice, which is amazing. And we got to learn from really exceptional women like that who had kind of paved the way for younger women of color like myself to start writing our own stories. And, you know, they transferred a lot of community knowledge to me to be able to take that cohort of 80 women and basically make two anthologies from that. The first one being Sweatshop Women Volume 1 and the second one being Sweatshop Women Volume 2. Which has been graced by a visual art cover by Amani Haider, who's an amazing women's rights advocate and author of The Mother Wound. And, you know, from that work that I did in 2018, I just kind of carry it on in my daily life. Lots of editing, lots of project management, and basically just talking to lots of writers and making sure that their writing stories that they want to read and that they want to write in the best way possible.
What about the mental load in a woman as young as you taking on board all those stories? Is that ever a consideration for you?
I am quite lucky in the sense that I live alone and I live in a very small unit that I was able to buy myself. And I don't have anybody who's dependent on me. Like, I don't have children. And I'm educated in terms of university and hoping to further my education. And so for me, I do have a lot of access to time to work on other people's stories, to work on my own career, and to build myself up as a leader, not only in Sweatshop, but in my own writing journey as the kind of first Tongan Australian novelist. So I feel very privileged in that regard. So my mental load does feel quite light anyway, because I have such privileges. But, you know, in my culture, we have this concept called Dala Noa, which is basically where we all sit in a circle and we basically all tell each other's problems, we tell stories, we give advice, and it can go on for hours and hours and hours. So I feel like even culturally, I'm quite good at being responsible with other people's stories and engaging with other people's, you know, lived experiences and traumas and joys, because my community taught me how to sit down and listen and take on that load through Dala Noa for hours and hours.
I had no idea about that, and it sounds like in Australian 20-year-old women, it's usually, or in my experience of being an Australian 20-year-old woman, it sounds like it involves a lot of wine.
yeah.
And usually in a bar, but your way of doing it sounds far more healthy and responsible.
Well, in the Tongan culture, in a specific kind of Dala Noa, there's gaba, which is a type of alcoholic drink as well. So not too far from each other.
look, yours is such an impressive story, and it's clear that you are very mindful of your responsibilities as a young leader and a leader of the future in your community. How do you want to position yourself? Am I too early in asking you that, or are you thinking actively about how you're positioning yourself?
Yeah, I'm always quite conscious of intersections, which is a term created by lawyer and activist who's also African-American, Kimberly Crenshaw, who used the concepts of intersections to discuss how kind of laws need to be applied differently or need to be applied with more consciousness when considering people's intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality, and ability. And so, you know, for me, I try to think of my advantages and disadvantages as much as possible. I think a lot of leaders or a lot of people who want to be leaders think it's a very static thing, that you're either privileged or you're not privileged. But we move back and forth between advantage and disadvantage in our everyday life. And so even though I am from a Pacific Islander background, even though I am a woman, even though I do consider myself bisexual as well, even though I have those intersections within me, like I said before, I also don't have kids. You know, I live alone. I'm university educated. So there's a lot of empowerment for me to be able to move in between those spaces. And so I do feel conscious of the fact that even though I do come from a Pacific Islander background, when people look at me, they don't necessarily think that I am. Like I don't look like a stereotypical Pacific Islander, and that comes with its advantages. And riding Dirt Poor Islanders, I wanted to be really conscious of that, because I didn't want those privileges and advantages to be the only thing that people saw in this very specific Tongan Australian story. I kind of wanted to use those advantages to open the door a little bit in the literary industry for people in my community who don't look like me, who don't have the specific advantages that I have, to be able to come in the door kind of afterwards. And so I feel conscious in that regard of seeing myself as kind of this first step or this first progression into what I hope will one day be a very broad, very rich Pacific Islander genre of literature in this country. Because if you look at somewhere like Aotearoa, like New Zealand, filled with Pacific stories from all across the South Pacific. And it's really embedded into their culture, not only because they have a very high percentage of different Pacific Islanders from all across the South Pacific Ocean, but also that their Indigenous population, who are Māori, also consider themselves to be Pacific Islander as well. So I'm hoping the way that I've written Dirt Poor Islanders, the way that I've situated Meadow Reed's story in that, I did that very consciously in the hopes that it's a stepping stone in the right direction.
Do you think, given the intersectional challenges perspective that you come from, it is genuinely harder to be taken seriously or to rise through the ranks of leadership or thought leadership in this country? Or are you finding that there's an opening and an advantage?
Yeah, well, look, I don't want to be all doom and gloom. Like, I really, really understand that the world from Chris Lilley 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we're so far removed from that now. Like, he was once a national icon and hero 10, 15 years ago. And just last year or the year before, he was banned from Netflix because of the racist, I would say, connotations of his work. And so I really understand that, you know, Australia as a continent is more open to growing and learning and being more equitable. And obviously I've found that my presence in the Australian arts community has only been a benefit because of that opening and because people and women like Dr. Randa Abdul-Fattah and Maxine Benaber-Clark and Michelle de Kretser, you know, were opening those doors when they were very, very much closed, when Australia was very, very just all about Chris Lilley and kind of no one else, or men like Chris Lilley. So I feel like my perspective and my intersections do give me and do give this continent an advantage. I will say the only thing that kind of stops me, I think, from being taken seriously in a larger context is my age, because I'm under 30. And so...
Well, that's, yes. Everything else is fine. It's just too young to be this crazily successful.
No, yeah. And so I think people, you know, still see me as quite young, and I've been told I have a very youthful energy. And so it does inhibit, I think, a lot of where I can move or where I can grow in my position of leadership. But again, I think that's important and integral to the process as well, because in my culture, like in Tongan culture, you're not really a leader until you've had lived experience, until you're able to live in a certain amount of time to be able to pass knowledge down to the next generation. And so I'm still learning and I'm still growing, and I don't think it's anti-feminist of me to say that I don't see myself as a leader, but that I see myself constantly moving in the direction of becoming a leader for my community one day.
And, you know, and this is why it's fascinating to talk to you as a young leader, essentially, and to hear your thoughts on how you do manage that. And when you do have a platform and you do have a book, you know, there are a whole lot of opportunities for you to be heard and seen.
Yeah, I also think we live in a very youth-obsessed culture, and I find it quite capitalistic. Yeah. When I think about it, that a lot of young people's voices are getting privileged over those with lived experience. And for me, that kind of knowledge is so important and integral to how the next generation forms their own ideas and their own ways of being. And we can't learn how to do that unless we're listening to those that came before us and who have that lived experience. And so, again, I'm always really conscious of the fact, like, oh, I'm young, like, I'm still learning. Like, please don't look completely to me for advice. Like, I still have to live, I think, another 20 years before I can, you know, really start talking about how to lead and how to, you know.
Look, and again, an incredibly insightful and wise answer. And I will just add to that, to anyone who's listening who's over 50, you know, this is a challenge in this country to take women over 50, women over 60 seriously, because we have got a youthful culture. And that is something that is occupying my time at FW, because increasingly this is coming up, not just from a member perspective, but from a policy perspective. You know, we've got women with all sorts of qualifications coming through the child rearing years feeling like they're past their use-by date professionally, and we've got a jobs and skills shortage in some key areas. And so, you know, it is an opportunity for us to address some of that ageism. So you are very correct on that. One last question for you. What leaders do you admire in this country?
Yeah, in this country in particular, for me at the moment, for women, it is definitely, and I think I've mentioned her a few times, so I think listeners might be able to know I'm obsessed with her, is Dr. Runda Abdul-Fattah. I've worked with her quite closely in the last few years, and she is the best-selling author of Does My Head Look Big In This, which came out in the mid-2000s, and I got to read in primary school. It was the first piece of literature by a person of colour that I read, and even though it wasn't my culture or my lived experience at all, I still found the fact that a different kind of cultural person was the centre of a story quite fascinating as a child in primary school. And then, you know, these days working with Dr. Runda Abdul-Fattah, she's done incredible leadership in terms of post-9/11 Australian era through her latest book, which is Coming of Age in the War on Terror. The other leader I actually look towards community-wise, and this might be quite funny, is actually Sonny Bill Williams. Because he's actually one of the most outspoken Pacific Islanders who is Muslim. And so the Pacific Islands are very much a Christianized nation, I would say. And that was through a lot of colonialism at the time, about 200 years ago. And so for him to kind of step out in a community leadership role in that kind of spiritual sense, I found has been really rewarding and beneficial to the Pacific Islander community in general, because it can give an alternative to the kind of views that they've grown up in a Christian context, and that, you know, faith is something that you can actually explore and discover as a Pacific Islander rather than being shamed to just kind of continue on and not feel like you have a choice in that regard. And so I think Sonny Bill Williams' leadership in that sense has been really integral.
Did you say you were raised in Christian faith?
Yeah. So I was raised, my parents weren't they were just kind of, I would say, culturally Christian. Like, I didn't go to church that often. But my grandmother, she was one of the founders, a leader in herself in a way, I guess. She was one of the founders of one of the first Tongan churches in Australia that was built in Southwest Sydney. And so I grew up in that church, which is kind of a off branch of something. I haven't been in a long time. But, you know, growing up in that faith as well, it was just another level for me of not being able to see myself in a position of authority, because the religion that we followed was so, it was literally the King James Bible. So at that point, you know, who are you really following? And, you know, who is God and Jesus being shaped by in that regard? And so I don't identify as Christian anymore, but, you know, for Sonny Bill Williams in particular, I think he provides a very good alternative for young Pacific Islanders to feel a bit more confident in discovering who they actually want to be, which I think is really important.
Winnie Dunn, thank you so much for your time. Absolutely fascinating discussion today. And I'm really looking forward to reading Dirt Poor Islanders, which is out this year. Thank you so much for your time. And I also, not only am I keen to read your book, I am keen to watch your career and your leadership journey. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, if anybody wants to follow me and that journey, please follow sweatshop.ws. That's our website, and you'll find our Instagram and our Facebook and our Twitter, and you'll be able to see kind of all the things that I do there. And yeah, hopefully some of your listeners have new books and stories to read.
This podcast was recorded on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Executive producer is Jennifer Goggin. Series producer is Holly Mitchell, and audio imaging by Nat Marshall.